This morning I want to talk about a very short koan that's on the cover of your program this morning, so you can refer there to what you have or look on with the person sitting next to you. It's the two lines at the top. This koan is not included in any collections, so it does not have a number or a title. So it's from Chinese Chan teacher, Zen teacher, named Baiyun, and it's a very short interchange with one of his students. And I'll talk about the second quote at the bottom later. But for those of you who do not have that in front of you, the interchange is as follows. A monk asked, "What is the great meaning of Buddhism?" Baiyun said, "Push the gourd beneath the water." What is the great meaning of Buddhism? Baiyun said, "Push the gourd beneath the water." So that sounds like a lot of these stories, doesn't it? Wow. What are you talking about? I love this story, actually. This one really jumped out at me. So the piece of historical relevance that I needed to make sense of this was that the assumption is, at that time in that culture, we all know that a gourd is what you use to gather drinking water. It has a hole in the top, right? So a gourd is your drinking vessel. It's your cup. It's your water bottle. It's your canteen. That's what it is, right? That's what he's instructing his student to do. Push the cup underneath the water. Push it beneath the water. And we also understand when we approach questions like the one the monk is asking, what is the great meaning of Buddhism, that that person is asking a very, very deep question that is certainly going to go beyond our ideas of meaning and most certainly go beyond our ideas of Buddhism. He's asking the big question, you know, the one Zen is famous for addressing. What is this? What is this? What is my life? What is my heart? What is God? What is the universe? What is this? What is this? What is the great meaning? What do I do? So I love that he's asking his teacher that question. I mean, that seems obvious because when we read any number of koans at all, that's always the question they're asking. But in real life, we rarely ask that question of our teachers. We usually say, "Hey, my back hurts after 20 minutes. What should I do?" That's a good question, right? My mind doesn't stop shutting up. Am I doing it wrong? That's also a good question. But at least in my experience, we don't often bring questions with this gravitas to a fellow human. Push the gourd beneath the water. Push the gourd. So there's a bunch to be said about this, and I'm really going to try to make my way through some of the notes that I've made today and not ramble too much. But what I think makes sense to start with is just to observe that the teacher is not answering his question. I mean, he's not giving you an answer. If you're that monk, what's the great meaning? Push your gourd further under the water. He's not giving you an answer. Oh, the answer is love and service. The answer is leave that horrible man. The answer is exercise every day and eat your salad. The answer is, when you die, you go to a wonderful place where there's nothing but Cheetos. He's not giving you an answer. He's encouraging, like a lot of us, need to be encouraged to find our own. Find your own, I don't know. But if you push your gourd into your water, I trust that you will find it. Right? He's empowering that student to continue to look and to look more deeply. Right, so I was fortunate enough to be raised in a family that did a lot of camping when I was a kid. And so when you spend a lot of time up in the Boundary Waters or out on the mountains of the West, at least when I was a kid, you didn't need to bring along sterilization tablets or run the water through a purifier or any of that kind of stuff. If it's flowing in the river, it's fine. Just dip in your cup and drink it. And if you're canoeing across Lake Sawbill, you get thirsty and you just dip your cup into the water. And the water right on the surface is going to be A-okay, right? Because it's a living lake, it's part of a living system, and the water is drinkable. But we also know, as folks who live in a land with 10,000 lakes. That was your cue to correct me. We have 12,340, but we're polite, so we only say 10. Anyway, as a good Minnesotan, I should know the actual number, but I know it's somewhere up there. That stagnant water, what do we know about lakes? We know that stagnant water is less likely to be healthy and that flowing water is more likely to be clean. Right? We know that about water. Stagnant water is more likely to be unhealthy for us. So those of us who are used to drinking out of a lake, you would be instructed, put your cup way under the surface, sweetie, because up at the top is where the duckweed is going to be and where insects are going to be and where anything that accumulates on the surface of the water is going to be. If you want the pure stuff, you have to go down about a foot. Does that make sense? Push your gourd underneath the water. So what does this have to do with our meditation practice? Because he's asking this question in a meditation setting, a monastery, we assume. He's getting an answer that's supposed to be relevant to Buddhist practice, an answer that's supposed to be relevant for somebody asking a very sincere question. At least I like to think it's very sincere, coming from a very deep place. It's coming from a deep place that requires an answer that encourages him to go to a deep place to find it. So here's my story, and I just heard this a few days ago. My story is not my story. It is from Nell Morton. Does anybody by any chance know Nell Morton? Okay, I didn't see any hands yesterday when I gave this talk either, but oh, she's my new hero. I'm really excited about Nell Morton, you guys. And I just learned about her this week. Nell Morton is now deceased, but she lived from 1905 to 1987. She's an American. She was a theologian, a professor, a feminist activist, and a civil rights leader. I'm like, how have I not heard of this person who's done all this amazing stuff? She wrote a book that's considered, at least in some circles, kind of a spiritual classic called The Journey is Home. And I heard the title, and I made the assumption, because she's an American who lived when she did, she's probably a Christian theologian. So I made the following assumption that she was Christian, and then I made the assumption about her title, The Journey is Home, that she would have made a great Zen teacher. Because, man, that's a great Zen title, right? The Journey is Home. The Journey is Home. Doesn't that sound like a Zen? Anyway. Okay. So I'll read this for you. It's two short paragraphs. It was in 1971 that I received a totally new understanding of hearing. It came from the lips of a most ordinary woman in a workshop that I was conducting. This is the voice of Nell Morton saying this. On the last day of the workshop, this woman, whose name I do not know, wandered off alone. And as we gathered sometime later in small groups, she started to talk in a hesitant and almost awkward manner. "I hurt," she began. "I hurt all over." She touched herself in various places before she added, "But I don't know where to begin to cry. I don't know how to cry." Hesitatingly, she began to talk to us. Then she talked more and more. Her story took on a fantastic coherence. When she reached a point of the most excruciating pain, no one moved. No one interrupted her. No one rushed to comfort her. No one cut her experience short. We simply sat. We sat in powerful silence. The woman clustered about the weeping one, went to her, to the deepest part of her life, as if something so sacred was taking place. They did not withdraw their presence or mar its visibility. Finally, the woman, whose name I do not know, finished speaking. Tears flowed from her eyes in all directions, and she spoke again. "You heard me. You heard me all the way." Her eyes narrowed, then moved around the group again slowly as she said, "I have a strange feeling you heard me before I started. You heard me to my own story. You heard me to my own speech." So Nell Morton's understanding of hearing was changed by that experience, and I can see why. I can really see why. It's easy for those of us who are Buddhist practitioners and are familiar with Dharma to understand what she is talking about there is the power of compassionate witnessing. That's all she's talking about there, the power of compassionate witnessing. A number of things strike me about this, and I've made a list. I'm laughing at that because Buddhism loves lists. Boy, we love lists. Lists and lists of lists and books of lists of lists. But before I give you my list, what I think is interesting about this story is it is both unremarkable and remarkable. Right? It's a bunch of people sitting around and one person talked and the rest listened. That's not remarkable. That's the most ordinary thing in the world. And yet when we hear this story, especially the way she describes it, we realize that's an unbelievably rare experience. And she actually lists all the reasons why it's rare. And she doesn't name them as such. This is my list. I'm inventing this list. But when I walk away from reading this, I'm like, this is the most human thing in the world. Why is this so hard? Why do I think this is remarkable? Why do I realize I've only been part of something like that maybe once, maybe twice in my life? Why is that so, right? Doesn't that seem weird that that would be rare? Somebody listened to a bunch of other people, big deal. A bunch of people listened to one person. Who cares? That's normal, right? That's what we do. But we don't. We don't. It's kind of like Zen teaching. Oh, just pay attention to what's going on. Just pay attention. Just pay attention. That's easy. Except for it's not. And except for we need to be reminded of it every 90 seconds. Because it's super hard. Even though it's super simple, right? This is super simple. What they're doing is super simple. Just listen. That doesn't mean it's easy. So here's what I see in that. I see a bunch of stuff in that. And I encourage you to spend more time with this on your own and see what you find. All I'm offering you is what jumped out at me. But I found 10 things in that. 10 phrases that Nell Morton uses to describe that experience that I think are incredibly important to what we're doing here. And I think the first two on my list of 10 we're already really good at as Zen students, right? The first one is, we sat in powerful silence. Isn't that a great phrase? Just the word powerful there. We sat in silence. That's easy. We sat in powerful silence. That adjective is brilliant, right? So if you've experienced silence before as powerful, you know what I'm talking about. We sat in powerful silence. We sat in powerful silence. And for all these years, it still amazes me. I think just sitting in the silence is what does the work, you guys. Doesn't it just sort of start working on you? When you give it enough time, it just starts working on you. It starts like bleeding in through your pores. Right? The power of that silence, it just becomes sometimes it's a window you can see through. Sometimes it's a mirror that just shows you the thing you don't want to see over and over and over. It won't let you run from it. Silence is powerful. There's no toys there. No toys. We sat in powerful silence. So as Zen students, we're good at doing this. We're pretty good at shutting up. Hi, welcome to Zen Center. Shut up. Also, welcome. We're glad to see you. All right? We sat in powerful silence. Number two, she says, we didn't move. We didn't move. There's a whole Dharma talk there. We didn't move. You chose to keep your seat. The thing showed up, and you wanted it, or you didn't want it, but you didn't move toward it. You didn't move away from it. You didn't move. What is that about? That's a pretty powerful sentence, too. As Zen students, we're also really good at that. We're pretty good at showing up, not talking, and not moving. The heart of Zen. Don't move. Shut up. These other eight things, I'm not sure we're so good at. Sometimes we are, sometimes we're not. Some of us are better at these things, some of us not. But this is really where it starts getting interesting. Because there's more to Zen than showing up and sitting still and not talking. Right? We know that. So the third thing she said is, we didn't interrupt. We didn't interrupt. That's interesting. Those of us who do Zazen with frequency have a hard time with this one sometimes. We struggle. When thoughts come, do I interrupt them? To come back to the breath, is that interrupting? What is that? Am I supposed to just let that run its course? At what point is redirection interruption? It gets fuzzy, right? You can sort of see right away, it's like, ooh, already this is fuzzy. Hold on a minute. What does interruption look like? Because interrupting is like amputating. Interrupting is like killing. Interrupting is like cutting off. What am I doing on the cushion? That's interesting. We didn't interrupt. And you can sort of see woven into the we didn't interrupt is, I trust that this is going to go where it needs to go, and that my interruption would only hurt here. Right? I'm more likely to interrupt something I think is of no value, because I've got something more important. Right? So busy mind. No. Count the breath. Surely counting my breath is more important than whatever it was I was just thinking about. Like, what's going on there? That's interesting, isn't it? We didn't interrupt, she says. The fourth thing she said is, we didn't rush to comfort. Ooh, that's a tough one for me. Right? When you're sitting in a group and somebody starts tearing up, I'm the first person to leap out of the circle and race across the room and grab the Kleenex and race back to that person. Because I'm being helpful! I'm being so helpful! I'm being so compassionate! Aren't I? Whoops. No, I'm not. Whose need am I meeting in that moment? It's not theirs. I like to think it is, because that would make me good. I'm meeting your need. I'm a bodhisattva. I'm not meeting your need. I'm anxious. I need to do something, right? This is my training. This is how I was trained as a kid. This is what taking care of someone looks like. When they do that thing, you do this thing, right? That's me taking care of you. That's about me meeting my own need. It also interrupts. It also disempowers. It also very subtly says, you know that crying thing you're doing? You might want to take care of that. You sort of feel it? Do you sort of feel the little subtle correction there? Now, I'm not saying don't ever get Kleenex for somebody. That's not the point of this Dharma talk. This is not a facial tissue-related Dharma talk. What I'm saying is, at some point, I was forced to pay very close attention to where that Kleenex-grabbing impulse came from in me. Because you bet I can get a Kleenex for somebody out of recognizing a deep need and just offering it. And it can be clean, and it can be beautiful, and they will see it and experience it as such. But what I am also very good at doing as a human is tricking myself into thinking it's about one thing, but it actually is about something else. And 9 times out of 10, if my compulsion is to get you Kleenex, it is in fact a compulsion, and that ain't compassion. That's me trying to, right? We didn't interrupt. We didn't rush to comfort. That's a fascinating line we're forced to walk when we encounter suffering. I want to be of comfort to you, but if I rush to you with that too quickly, I'm taking away your own power. I'm taking away your own ability. I'm telling you, you are not strong enough to do this on your own. You need me. You kind of see where that could show up? Like, ooh, this is tough. Oh, no wonder this experience is so rare. No wonder this doesn't happen all the time. Right? Wow, we didn't rush to comfort. Number 5, she says, and this is all Nell Morton. I'm just pulling these things out into a list. Number 5, she says, we didn't cut her experience short. We didn't cut it short. They just let it unspool. And there's a lot of details we don't understand here. I don't know how long the time was. I don't know how much time elapsed, or if they had, you know, a certain time set aside for this group and they needed to wrap it up and be out of there by 5. I know none of those details. But the way she's letting the story tell itself, you kind of get the impression, at least I do, they're going to let this thing unspool because they're going to let it unspool. They're just going to trust it's going to end up where it needs to go when it ends up there. No problem. That seems pretty brilliant to me. We didn't cut it short. Number 6, we did not withdraw our presence or mar its visibility. We didn't withdraw our presence. We know what that means. We didn't pull away. And we also didn't cover what was there. So I know you guys know this experience. When you're talking to somebody and they begin to withdraw their presence, you know it. And sometimes it's really obvious, like, ooh, right? And they cross their arms and they yawn and they roll their eyes and they look at the ceiling. it's pretty obvious, okay, that's their nonverbal cue of going, come on in, wrap it up, right? Or they will interrupt you, or they will think of some way to physically remove themselves. But we've also, I think, had this other sensation where somehow we just feel like they just punched out just now. Something just happened there. And maybe I didn't see it, but I could feel it. They withdrew their presence. And it might be something really subtle when you're talking to somebody. And then she did this, and then she walked in, they go, You can kind of feel, oh, they're starting to pull back. They're rushing me. They're not as interested as they were, right? You can sort of feel. And it is a feeling. It isn't something we see. It's like, I can sort of feel that you're pulling back from me. You've reached the edge of your comfort. Right? You're pulling back from me. But the other extreme is marring its visibility. When she says we did not mar the visibility of our presence, we didn't hide it. It was right there. We made sure that they could, that this woman who was in such pain could see that they were present to her. It was really obvious. They weren't being sideways about it. It's right here. I'm listening to you. Number seven. This is the woman now who's sharing her experience in the story. You heard me all the way. I think as Zen students, we're good at the first three words of that. You heard me. But all the way, that's harder. That becomes a human problem. All the way is much harder. And this comes up in our practice, specifically in Zazen, a lot. Because, right, Dogen says you're turning the light inward. You're taking the backward step. Right, your job is to hear, be aware of, be in contact with that which is showing up, right? Thoughts, emotions, bodily sensations, right? You are punched in. Zazen is alive. It is active. You're not withdrawing. You're in there. You're engaged. You hear it. All the way? Well, I'm here to do Zazen. So if all the way involves a storyline that wants to play itself out or an emotion that seems like it's leading someplace big, maybe I'm not hearing it all the way. Maybe I'm going to cut that off after 5 seconds. Go count your breath. You can sort of see how, depending on the setting, one of those would be really skillful, and maybe in another setting, one would not be skillful. Maybe on the cushion for 20 years, I've actually been cutting it off. I haven't been hearing it all the way. Where does that go? I do not know. I do not let it get there. After 5 minutes, I realize that there's a narrative, that there's an emotion, and I'm getting in it, and I cut it by returning to counting, or even by returning to breath awareness. What's going on there? When is that helpful centering, and when is that avoidance? Right? When is that staying on the surface and making sure it doesn't go too deep? Ooh, this is getting it's very fuzzy, isn't it? And our meditation instruction from these teachers from 800 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago, sometimes they're very clear about techniques and sometimes they're very vague. Take a backward step. Well, okay, Dogen, come on, man. What do I do when, right? Do I let this play all the way out or do I not? Is the narrative bad or is it good? Am I here to feel or not to feel? Right? Tim talks about this a lot, spiritual bypass. If we aren't careful, these techniques that are brilliantly wise and can be incredibly supportive and helpful for us can very subtly turn into avoidance, 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 avoidance. I only touch the top level because I never let it play out. I'm super good at counting to 10. I've been doing it for a long time. I can do that for a week at a time. How do you feel? I do not know. That's not my business. Right? I've been instructed that counting to 10 is my business. Wow, really? So you get it, right? So, then she says something else. Her story took on a fantastic coherence. That's the eighth phrase I found. Her story took on a fantastic coherence. So I love that phrase, fantastic coherence. Isn't that great? They almost seem like two different things, because fantasy always seems like, blah! They're unicorns and M&Ms the size of the moon. And then, but it was coherent. It was linear. It made sense. And from hearing the way she talks about this story, this woman starts, she can barely even speak. She does not know what's going on. All she knows is she hurts, and she's touching various parts of her body. She doesn't know where it comes from. She has no idea what she's processing. She doesn't know what she's doing. But as she starts to talk, all this stuff just starts to pour out of her. And slowly but surely, there's an assembly that takes place, right? A gestalt. All those crazy scattered stars become a constellation. And it's like, ah. It was coherent. They're trusting the narrative to show up as coherent. So what that tells me is there was no editor in that room. Right? These women who are listening to her are not editing, going, oh, you're getting off topic. Hey, you're off topic. Remember you were talking about horses a minute ago? Now you're talking about M&Ms. Come on now. Right? There's no editor. They're just trusting that at some point all of these things are going to roll together into one coherent, and that she describes that coherence as fantastic. Isn't that cool? Fantastic coherence. Keep in mind, this woman is telling a story of great suffering. She's telling a story of great suffering, and yet the coherence was fantastic. Isn't that cool? There's joy in suffering, right? Right? There better be. Because we get a lot of suffering, you get. You know that already. Okay, good. There's a lot of joy there. There's a coherence there. There's a coherence. Okay. Number 9. You heard me. You heard me to my own story. The nature of their witnessing helped her find the story. When she sat down, she did not know what the story was. By the end, she knew what the story was. Why? Because of compassionate witnessing. She was heard to her own story. I love that. That's about her own inner awareness. She walks out knowing her story. She didn't know when she walked in. She knew when she walked out. Wow. Compassionate witnessing gave her the gift of her finding her own story, right? This is her own gourd. She's pushing underneath her own water. She's doing it. They're just letting her do it. And then finally, number 10, you heard me to my own speech. And what I love about this is when it begins to move out. Everything we've talked about so far has been inner. All her own inner. And now it starts to move out. So not only does she know her own story, but now she can speak it. Right? So our practice here is designed to go out. We have to go out. This world, this suffering world, is dying to hear your story. And I don't mean where you're born, what you do for a living, what your favorite Power Ranger is. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about your story. Story. The big one. About your massive suffering and your redemption. That is the story this world is aching to hear. There are 7 billion of us who are experiencing the thing called human life. It's infinitely deep, infinitely variable. It is connected to every other thing. Your story, if you go down deep enough into it, you will come up in me. I need that. Because when I go down deep enough into mine, I will come up in you. That's how this works. We call it interconnectedness. It's actually more intimate than that, interbeing. Right? We need the story, the true one. We need that. And so what I love about this whole story that Mel Morton is telling is, yes, it's a story of remarkable people doing a remarkable thing. It's also a story of normal people doing a normal thing. All they're doing is listening. We hear it is remarkable. And I think the crucial part, the absolute crux of this whole thing, is that the story she's telling is one of pain. I think that's so important. Of course, it'd be just as miraculous if she was telling a story about the time she was helping her son learn to ride a bike. That'd be really cool, too. That's a really important part of the great story, too, right? The tapestry contains all the threads. But the reason this is such a remarkable story for us is the way they responded to her suffering. And every single thing she lists there almost feels countercultural. You showed me your suffering, and I didn't rush to comfort. I didn't interrupt. I didn't cut your experience short. I didn't even move. I didn't withdraw my presence. I heard it all the way. I think this is remarkable to us because we have such a hard time with this. It's so hard for us to bear witness to suffering in that way. It's the Buddhist path. It's exactly the Buddhist path. That's all we do, the First Noble Truth. This is the thing that happens to everyone. Life is characterized by this thing called dukkha. It is the wagon wheel that is out of balance, right? Dukkha comes from the same root as the word in Sanskrit for the wheel that's out of balance. Sure, it functions, but it's not that great. Right? Does that sound like your life? Sure, it works, but not that great. It doesn't quite, right? And sometimes it's really not great, and sometimes it's almost good, but you can sort of, You know, I had a whole bunch of ice get in my wheel well last Sunday when I was here shoveling. You know how it kind of freezes in overnight? And then, you know, you pull out, and of course it's still frozen in there. And then you're going down the highway at 60 miles an hour and you can feel your car going, and you're like, oh, right, because in a few days that's, you know, going to thaw and it'll be normal. But as I'm going down the highway at 60 miles an hour, Stevie's going, oh, that's my car, Stevie. I'm like, oh, don't worry, sweetie, you're just having some dukkha. This is like car dukkha, right? Like, well, it works. I'm going 60, but you can feel it, right? I'm shaking. Like, yeah. So we all know this feeling. We all know this feeling, the universality of suffering, the universality of suffering. And Mahayana Buddhism does this unbelievably beautiful thing, this incredibly beautiful thing, this thing that still blows my mind, that says this is the baseline human experience. It's like breathing, which means everybody gets it, which means it's where we can connect. You know what this is like. I know what that's like when you tell me I'm so sad because of that, and I go, oh yeah, I know sad. Now we're connected, just like that. If you say skydiving, I might go, no, I've never skydived, never done that. So you'll have to tell me about it and that'll be cool, but I don't know that experience. But if you say I went skydiving and I was terrified, I'll go, oh, I know terrified. I give Dharma talks. Right? When we get down to the base feeling, it becomes universal. It becomes universal. So we never hear a single detail about this woman's story. It doesn't matter. I don't know what happened. Did she put her cat to sleep? Is her son in prison? Is she in the middle of a divorce? Did she get a breast cancer diagnosis? I don't know. But at some point, the details of the story don't matter. She starts at the details, her, and she goes all the way down in, and then she comes up in them. Because suffering is universal, and we get it. That's the genius of Mahayana Buddhism. That's why suffering is our great teacher. It isn't the enemy to be vanquished. It isn't the cancer to be cut away. It's, I want to understand you. I must get closer to you. I must hear you all the way if I'm to understand it. So, I'm going to shift gears, because everything that she talked about in that story is our job, and it's internal. Yes, we want to bear witness to one another the way those women bore witness to her. Yes, we do. But here's the deal. Our ability to do that is entirely dependent upon our ability to do it for ourselves. Everybody knows that. It's really irritating. You can only love someone as much as you love yourself. Yeah, I know. I've seen the bumper sticker. You can only love someone as much as you love. I know. I read the Hallmark card. You can only love someone as much as you. I know. Right? And what's irritating about it is it's true. I hate how true it is. But that's true. It's true, true. Right? So if I'm meeting with somebody, whether it's here in a formal capacity at MZMC or it's somebody at the grocery store or the co-op or it's my wife or it's my kid or it's my dad or it's my neighbor, and they're coming to me with suffering in of any kind, day-to-day annoyance or big, like this woman shared, my ability to maintain a compassionate presence to that person is exactly as much as I can deal with that own feeling in me. There's no mystery here. That's actually the formula 100% of the time. If I cannot bear witness to my own suffering, I cannot bear witness to yours. So when I'm telling a story and myself going, oh my God, I've got to go grab those Kleenex right now, that's because you've just reached my capacity. That's how much I can handle. That's how much I can handle. Now I got to start problem solving. I got to start problem solving. I got to interrupt. I got to take control. I got to give you something. I got to, you can feel it, right? I'm at my capacity. That's not bad. That's my capacity. That's not a bad capacity, right? That's not me failing. That's just me recognizing this is as far as I can walk with you. And I can still be polite, and I can still be present, and I can still stay in my chair, right? But on some level, I'm unable to witness this suffering as deeply as I need to because my own capacity just isn't there yet. Right? And so on the cushion, when we're doing Zazen, over years of doing this, we watch people's capacity get bigger and bigger and bigger. Right? To stay with affliction, to stay with the moment as it is, things as it is. Things as it is includes the emotion. It includes the narrative. It includes the physical sensations. It includes the history. It includes the past. It includes the future. It includes the right. That was Tim's latest blog post, Things As It Is. And Suzuki said, oh, be with things as it is. Unless they're afflictive, then just trip out. Just imagine stuff. Push it away. Use your counting as a way of subtly repressing your experience. Do you kind of get it? Things As It Is includes that. Somebody teaching Things As It Is, who lived through weed soup during World War II, knows what Things As It Is, and honestly being present all the way down means. All the way down. Cultivate the bare soil. We go down to the soil. Not just, I want the flower. Yeah, I know. How about the soil? What if it's growing dandelions? The soil, the soil. I want to go all the way down. So this is so rewarding, you guys. This practice is so incredibly rewarding because when we watch ourselves be part of an experience like Nell Morton describes and watch my own ability to be present to my own story all the way down, as that increases, my awareness of the thing called the human condition increases. That's what I'm here to do. As a Zen practitioner, what is my project? Awareness, awareness, awareness. Awareness, awareness, awareness. That's my job. I want to become more aware. I want to become more aware. And part of how humans know, part of our awareness system is emotions, physical sensations, thoughts. They're all giving me information in real time. Real time responses to my surroundings are thoughts, physical sensations, emotions, impulses. They're called the skandhas. There's five of them. They're giving me real time information about my experience. And if my job is awareness as a Zen student, I should be pretty intimate with all five of those things. They should not be enemies. They should not be enemies. So this teaching is humbling for me because of how much time I've spent avoiding my own suffering. I don't think I have any more suffering than anybody else. I think I've got the average human amount. I probably just went through the line once when they're handing it out. I don't know how it works. But I am humbled. I'm genuinely humbled by how often I have been encouraged to push my gourd under the water and how often I have kept my gourd on the surface because I was... And there's not a... I want to be clear about what I'm saying here. I'm humbled by. I'm not ashamed of. My capacity was my capacity. That's okay. That wasn't me failing and now succeeding, because that's not it. It was me having that capacity and now having this capacity. And I hope very much that I'll listen to a recording of this talk in 5 years and go, oh, my capacity was so small back then. I can't believe they let me give talks. I had no idea what I was talking about up there. Now my gourd is big. My arms are longer. I can go down to deeper water. It's just, you know, it's not stepladdery. We just do what we can. We just do what we can. But the humility part is knowing now what I didn't know then, which is at some point in the arising of experience, I make a choice to ignore. I make a choice to not feel. And I don't know that I'm doing it. But at some point, I choose, right? I choose to go grab the Kleenex. I choose to turn on the YouTube cat videos. I choose to leave the room. I choose to space out. This happens a lot in Zazen. I'm like, oh, there's that feeling again. Whoosh. You know, Dogen was really wise. He has that verse that wow, there's my escape valve. I needed something. It got a little too hot. I had to pull away. It got a little too hot. I went up into my head. That's what we usually do. We go up into our head, up in our head. I choose ignorance so often. So Einstein said, only two things are infinite, the universe and human stupidity. And I'm not sure about the former. You guys all know that one. Isn't that great? It's almost like he was reading our vows. Delusions are inexhaustible. Vowing to extinguish them. I'm like, yeah, I know that feeling. So I like that our response to our infinite capacity for stupidity is a vow to continue to do it. My ability to stay on the surface is infinite. I vow to continue to push the gourd under. So what's our vow? Our vow is to be loving, non-anxious presence to experience. My vow as a Zen practitioner is to be a loving, non-anxious presence to my experience. And when I hear that vow, and when I recite the vows, and somebody says that sentient beings are numberless, or our translation just says beings are numberless, I go, oh yes, look at them all. There's Raymond and Steve and Ted. There's a being. And look, the light and the fan and the beams and the ceiling, those are beings, right? And the air is beings. Because Tim is my teacher, so we get really trippy about stuff all the time. It's all beings. There are no... Am I right? Yes, Tim is even probably a being, I guess. That's weird to think about. But rarely do I imagine those beings are inside me, those suffering beings. When sad shows up, when angry shows up, bored shows up, stiff knees show up, really sad memory, hope that I'm pretty sure is going to get dashed. Oh, I'm supposed to those two? Oh, I get it. The universe inside is so much larger than the universe outside. And my vow has to be big enough to encompass them both. That's my vow, to be a loving, non-anxious presence to my experience. To my experience. And I know there's no me here. I start to understand that after a while. But when I can be a loving, non-anxious presence to my experience, I can be a loving, non-anxious presence to your experience. And the suffering of your heart, your ecosystem, your race, your family, your gender, your country, that's all about my own capacity. The work is always right here, right here, right here, right here. And naturally then it flows. It's just like what she said in that story, like, you heard me to my own story, you heard me to my own voice. It doesn't stay inside long. It just immediately overflows, right? It just does. It just does. We can't not act. It's too late. We're already acting. It flows out. It flows out. My ability to be here is my ability to be there. My ability to care about this and set healthy boundaries here and respect this thing with love and ferocity. I can't help but start doing the same for you, right? It just flows out. So, I'm going to wrap up here. I'm going to skip the other three pages of my talk. I never get to them. I'll wrap up with this. If we wish to become agents, and I trust that we do. I actually trust that every being does, and we oftentimes don't know it. I think we do cruel, horrible things out of very unskillful and misguided attempts just to meet a basic human need. We're not that complicated, you guys. We're not. Even the most horrible thing that was ever done is just a misguided, unskillful attempt at trying to meet a basic human need. When you peel yourself enough on the cushion, you see it. That's it. It's just a scared kid. It's always just a scared kid. Right? Aren't you all just scared kids? For those of you listening at home, everyone nodded. They are all scared kids. Okay. So, if we wish, we, all beings... We're also Buddhas, which is weird. Anyway, if we wish to become agents for compassionate and loving change in a suffering world, we need to find our most genuine, our most real, our truest voice. We need to act from a place of deep authenticity, deep integrity, deep commitment to what we know to be true, which is a deep connection to our own lived truth. If I cannot face my own truth squarely, without obfuscation, without lies, avoidance, distraction, judgment, how can I possibly face your truth? How can I possibly be an agent for positive change if I cannot even bear loving witness to that which I wish to change? I can't even touch it, let alone feel it, or understand it, or claim to know it. How do I know how to fix brokenness if I cannot face or feel how it is broken, or love it enough to understand and to care that it hurts? So this compassion practice requires diligence and discipline and lots of patience. And those are three things that Zen students are really good at. We're good at diligence. We're good at discipline. We're really patient. We just hang in there and keep pushing the gourd under the water. Just keep pushing the gourd under the water. We just show up, don't we? Isn't that amazing? We just keep showing up and pushing the gourd under the water. That's what we do. So thank you for doing this. Thank you for doing it with me. Thank you very much. And we have a few... We don't have too many. I wandered a while, but we have a few minutes. Does anybody have any thoughts, questions, comments, anything they'd like to... Ashley?
Do you find as a parent that it... harder to not be that sort of impulsively, if you want to try and solve your child or your niece's problem, yeah. Find it that that it's harder to be more observant or more
So Ashley's asking whether or not, as a parent, it would be harder to not rush in with the box of Kleenex, essentially. I'm not a parent, so I don't know. But it makes perfect sense that it would be harder. It makes perfect. It's flesh of your flesh. Just flesh of your flesh. So you're going to feel, most parents, feel a connection to an offspring in such a deep way. It's biological. I mean, their suffering is your suffering. Their joy is your joy. It would make perfect sense. But I do think the truism remains the truth that, in fact, kids are actually a brilliant example of this, is because I'm so connected to you, I will rush in too soon. And that's still about my connection to myself. My capacity for suffering is still entirely an internal thing. And so, yeah, most parents I've ever talked to or known were very quick to confess, oh, yeah, I'm way too corrective. I'm just way too corrective, of course. And it's easy to find forgiveness around that because it's like, well, yeah, it's your kid. Of course. But knowing what that energy in us is actually, I think, is all the more important. Because so many times we think, I'm doing all this thing that's helping and supporting you. Why aren't you grateful? Because the kid's like, all you did was control. And you're kind of like, ooh, I intended that to be this. And you're seeing it as that. So if I'm most parents, I'll go, well, then your perception is wrong, stupid kid. Because that was love. Until we're really, really, really wise, and we fast forward a couple decades, we've been sitting staring at a wall in this weird zendo, and we start going, oh, whoops. Yeah, shoot, you got me. That was actually me trying to control you. Your experience of suffering made me so uncomfortable I could not sit still anymore. And it's not that there's not a time to act. Obviously, there's a time to act, but being very clear about where in me I'm acting from, that's the work. What a great question. Did that make sense to folks? Yeah. Carrie?
So what she just said and what you just said reminded me of a book that was published in 1980 by two women, Faber and Bagshaw, How to Talk to Your Kid While Listening and How to Listen to Your Kid While Talking. And I remember coming across this book in early childhood family education class in the 90s. And I'm just wondering why, I can only speak from being an American woman, born when I was born, and I didn't learn this. I had to read this book in order to come up with a different skill set so I could listen to my child.
Yeah.
I still don't do it well. and so is it American cultural? Are we... As infants, we would not have been influenced by our American culture to do it differently, or is it just being human that this arises?
What a great question. Did you guys hear that? She's wondering how much of this scripting we get around distancing ourselves is American culture and how much of it is just human. I don't know. I'm this too. This is just me. I'm just a kid from Bloomington. But the way it feels is this is just humans. It just feels like this is just the human thing. This is just the human thing. If I can't even be honest about where I'm at, the fact that I hurt, I can't be present to that. Of course I can't do it for you. That feels so basic as to be... But what I do share with you, it sounds like you're saying, Carrie, is the wonderment of, like, how was I actually never taught this? I'm allowed to roam freely. I mean, that's insane. I can drive a car. I can vote. And I was never taught this. I mean, you know how it is when you sort of discover some of this, like, Buddha stuff? Like, oh, yeah, we're never going to tell you, by the way, where your suffering is. Or where it comes from, or how you're going to go around in the world blindfolded swinging a sword. We're not going to bother telling you that, even though your capacity for causing suffering is hilariously high. We're not going to tell you any of that stuff. Just figure it out. Good luck. I mean, it's almost like a practical joke. Oh, my God. So, yeah, I have the same thing. I just lament. Why wasn't I taught this when I was 3? Oh, sweetie, I know why you're sad. It's because of this, But I'm guessing that's just the human. It's the evolution of our consciousness. We figure it out when we figure it out. What a great question, Carrie. Thank you. Peter.
Well, just to add on this, I spent a lot of time trying to think about, and the piece that I'm going to refer to is the hearing the person all the way through.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of us can build the skill to start down that, but staying with it, and I start to notice, well, what are the things that tend to interrupt or cut off the process. And I think one that relates to being a parent or a leader or somebody in a powerful position is this concept we have that I have a responsibility. And that sense of responsibility is about me doing something to you rather than being present with you.
Yeah.
And I have to pay attention to when did I make up a job description that really is having exactly the opposite impact I want to have.
Yeah.
I may get this reference wrong, but I remember something that stuck with me from the Tao Te Ching is this idea of leading without interfering.
Yeah.
And I think that we have to redefine what it means to be a parent or a leader to say it's respecting that self-organizing energy out there and noticing it and supporting it and nudging it occasionally, but not having to be responsible for it.
Yeah.
Lots of aspects of our society punish us for not being able to allow people to finish things out in their own voice. Every single aspect of my job punishes me for allowing people to kind of come to it the way that they would want to come to and let it be what it is.
Yeah.
If I were to allow that to happen, well, I'd be fired because I'm not producing enough unitized labor, or because I might not do a thing that a guideline says I ought to, or I'm not going to be allowed to let that person solve their own problems as opposed to being the hand that solves things for them, because that's what our organization does, or that's what our entity does. And once you realize that, that's a really hard genie to put back in the bottle.
Yeah, you're right. There's so much. I'm aware of the time. I know we have to wrap up here. But this, even hearing her story, you can feel how countercultural all that accidentally was. Because everything that she lists, we didn't do this, we didn't do this, we didn't do this. I thought, well, I would have done that, and then I would have done it exactly everything she said. That's how I was trained, like very specifically. This is what success looks like. You know, and her crying is not you succeeding. Right? People aren't supposed to be sad. Sad is bad. Right? And you're like, but that's not true. So it's massively countercultural, yeah. All right, folks.